Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Wednesday. It's the 8th of February, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And our first guest, our opening guest, is none other than a socioeconomic research scholar, Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. And his most recent essay is entitled "The Elite's War on Ordinary Workers Continues," and it's written naturally by him, Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. So good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, it was a pleasure to read this. Very, very complex. It probably went over my head to a great extent. And that's why it's very, very important that you decipher a lot of this for me. I guess the thing that was most compelling is that the Fed is evidently launching a war, not on inflation, but more so a war on workers. How did you come to that conclusion? And is that the role of the Fed, or should it be?
Well, first of all, it's not the role of the Fed. And second of all, I'm sure the Fed would doubt vociferously that they are actually doing that. They're simply trying to fight inflation. And, you know, there would be consequences and some people will be hurt. The chips fall where they may, but they're not necessarily targeting anybody specifically in that regard. So that's their argument. Nevertheless, the consequences are well known. When you raise interest rates, and that's the formula for controlling for inflation, then what is going to happen is you will basically induce a recession. That's part of what the objective is, to create a recession to basically bring down prices. Again, they're going to deny that that's the goal. They're going to say they're trying to do a controlled raising of interest rates. They're trying to create a soft landing. All these terms that they're using. But the reality is their primary objective, their key constituency, is the banking industry, and that's who they are charged to serve.
Well, do people realize that, or they don't? This is really just in the stratosphere where people like you, with your expertise, recognize that. But certainly, if they claim the Fed claims that they're trying to control inflation. But would it be so bad? Is there not a better balancing act between inflation and the loss of jobs and also allowing for growth in industry? Or there isn't any?
Well, I'm not sure that people, they know what the correct balancing act is. I mean, they have there are metrics that they use, and the chief metric has always been, is there something called inflationary pressure? And that has been, was guided interest rate hikes at least for many years, at least until the Great Recession in 2008, when basically they decided to lower interest rates and keep them artificially low, pretty much through the pandemic. So, That's where we're at right now. The reality is we've had unemployment for such a long time. It was deep unemployment, and there was nothing you could do other than bring more money into the economy somehow. And that really wasn't exactly doing the job either. But in some ways, it's a helpless institution for managing the economy, but it's the only institution we seem to have because Congress doesn't want to do its job of fiscal policy. Even then, it's not clear if fiscal policy is the right answer either.
So do we know what the right policy would be? Can one balance these two, I guess, disparate interest?
Yeah, we have
you know,
theories.
On the one hand, taking care of business, and on the other hand, taking care of the employer and the employee.
Yeah, we have theories about what drives the economy, but the employee has never been forefront in the minds of Fed Reserve governors. So, you know, again, when you get right down to it, employees are workers or they're factory labor, or they're called labor, which are factors of production. So they're inanimate objects, so nobody really thinks of workers as people. So if you talk about the unemployment rate, it's basically a number, it's a statistic, which is meaningless. These are statistics which have no names, they don't have faces, they have no identities. So they're not real people who are suffering the consequences. It's like you can talk about, you know, 12 million jobs, as the president claimed last night in the State of the Union address. Nobody knows what kinds of jobs were created, but people are still suffering, and they can't make ends meet because of inflation. So to say the economy is doing well is kind of nonsensical. But the Federal Reserve Board is relied upon to manage the economy based on language that was put into the Employment Act of 1946. So, and basically because Congress doesn't want to take responsibility for fiscal policy, it simply has deferred to the Fed, which is independent of both the president and the Congress. In other words, once the president appoints somebody to be on the Federal Reserve Board and they're confirmed by the Senate, that they can't be removed by either branch of government. That's how independent this board is. It's essentially the definition of an independent regulatory commission. And the powers are immense in terms of its impact on the economic health of the nation. And that's why you see people like, you know, Rand Paul take to the airways and the Senate floor denouncing the Fed and saying we need to get rid of the Fed and things of that nature. Everybody knows full well he'll do no such thing because Congress is not there to, fulfill its responsibility of representation. It doesn't believe in that, basically believes in deferring to others. That's how Congress operates. It has been operating for quite some time. Do people know about the independent nature of the Fed? Some people probably understand it. If they've taken the basic economics course in college, they understand what the Fed's independent. Do they understand that the Fed's primary constituency is the banking industry? Probably not.
No. Yeah, that's really the whole thing. I didn't realize until I read your essay how removed the Fed is from the individuals that are employees, because they don't have names, they just have numbers. And numbers are meaningless. There's no emotion involved with numbers. So it's just, I don't know, it's meaningless. But if you knew it was Carol and Jane and John and Michael, then it would make a difference. Because then you would connect with them. Is there no mechanism at the moment then? Because you say Congress, what can Congress do to change this dynamic? Can they impose something on the Fed? Can they remove the term of office so that maybe it shouldn't be for once you're appointed, you never get off until you drop dead. I mean, how does this work?
Well, it doesn't work quite that way. It's not like the Supreme Court. Basically, that they are fixed terms. So each Fed governor serves a 7-year term. The federal mm-hmm. chair serves a 4-year term, and it overlaps presidential administration. So the Fed chair that Biden inherited, then he reappointed. He has that option. He could have picked somebody else, but he reappointed Powell, who was appointed initially by Trump.
Right.
And Fed chairs do try to appeal or please new administrations as much as they can because they have an interest. They want to be reappointed. So that's the thinking, but at the same time, they are independent of the president and Congress. What can Congress do? They can rewrite the legislation. They would have to go back and take the 1913 Federal Reserve Act and basically redo it, amend it, so whatever. But they have to rewrite the legislation allowing for more strict controls of Congress. Now, the Fed chair does appear before Congress, does testify before Congress in oversight committee hearings. But again, there's very little that Congress can do short of rewriting the legislation, the initial legislation that has basically enabled the Fed. And it's doubtful that the Congress would do that, because then they would have to assume responsibility for managing the economy. And again, they don't have solutions either. I mean, the standard, I mean, monetary policy in some ways is equates to fiscal policy. And traditional fiscal policy, times of recession, you want to lower taxes so people have money to invest and buy things, create aggregate demand for goods and services. And in times of inflation, you want to raise taxes so you can basically limit people's demand for goods and services and basically bring prices down. Well, what Congress is going to raise taxes? Very few. And even when talk about lowering taxes as the typical fiscal policy solution, we have so much debt now, and we have so much expenditures, and we have deficits, that basically every time we talk about a tax cut, it has to be, we talk about having to pay for it. So you have to find the money to pay for the tax cut through saving somewhere else. So it's very difficult to even achieve that. So no Congress wants to touch these issues with a 10-foot pole. And it's much easier for members of Congress just to bash the Fed publicly and then say, I'm sorry, constituency, but my hands are tied behind my back.
Mm-hmm. And, like, for example, yesterday's speech from the president, you know, I don't know if he got collaboration by the applause that he got in some cases, and it seemed that it was the entire Congress that was clapping for him at one time or another, or so he claimed. I was listening to it on radio, and but the amount of money that is being put out there, is that going to change the equation? It looks like for so much money that's being spent for one program after the other, and yet I don't know if more jobs are being generated at the end of the day. A lot of subsidies seem to have been coming out. Is that doable, or is that going to add on more debt?
I haven't seen the budget, so I really don't know what's doable and what's not doable. But again, the standard criticism
that's what I was afraid of. It's too early to tell.
Among neoclassical economists, it's most likely going to be the more spending at the federal level, the more pressure that puts on inflation, basically that adds to the inflation, devalues the dollar, and raises prices. The government spending money, people basically look for government contracts, and you know they try to charge the highest price because of third party paying the bill. This is part of standard stuff. Someone's arguing this is a contributing factor to the inflation levels that we have. It's not the root cause, although some Republicans in Congress would like to tell you it is the root cause, but it's not really the root cause. It may be a contributing factor, which is exacerbated, but the root causes are basically a supply chain crisis. I'm sure people like to hear we're going to bring industry back to the United States from China. That would be a great help. I think the real issue here is because the root causes is a supply chain crisis, then really there was no reason for the Fed to swing into action and raise interest rates in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And what about, is it conceivable that even if the United States decided to focus on getting more people employed, for the workers, can we be competitive? Can we still, or even just match the Chinese? Do we need to trade so much with China, or should we live with what we can afford to build at the prices that we have? Would that balance out our economy and our workers' needs and inflation, or no?
Well, a fully self-sufficient economy that's not exporting or importing is also known as a poor economy. So we do need to trade with somebody. We need to have markets outside of the United States. We need to export. Now, You know, I think there are two questions here. One is growth rate, and two is development. So when we talk about job creation, my concern is much of that is concentrating on economic growth. You can have growth without having any real development. Development, mm-hmm. you're talking about manufacturing, creating things, your new plants and jobs are going to go someplace. But if it's the jobs that you're creating or you're adding, I don't know, the 12 million jobs that the president claims were created, I don't know if they're simply old jobs that have been unfilled for quite some time during the pandemic. They could be service sector jobs. They could be hospitality sector jobs, basically not mm-hmm. necessarily good-paying jobs. And if you're talking about economic development, you're talking about good-paying jobs. So when we're talking about creating jobs, you want good-paying jobs. The theory behind lowering interest rates during a recession is the idea that if companies have more money to spend, or it's cheaper to obtain money, they will make investments in plants and equipment. In other words, that's the way they will create jobs for people. That's what you want to do during a recession. The problem, however, is there's really no reason for them to do so unless there's aggregate demand for their goods and services. That's why, you know, you need to look at industries which are interest rate sensitive. So in other words, when we say, okay, the Fed is basically raising interest rates to control for inflation, and part of what they're doing is they're doing it blindly, you know, figuring the chips forward or nay. But I think everybody understands, but most people understand that, you know, most likelihood you're looking at industries that are going to most likely suffer the ill effects of a Fed action are those industries which rely heavily on people borrowing money, mm-hmm. you know, cars, you know, durable goods, you know, construction, things like that, the interest rate sensitive industries, that's where you're going to see a recession and job loss. And of course, then you have ripple effects, tertiary effects as a result.
Are we getting some guidance about what's happening you know, at the high tech industry, you know, when you have like Meta in trouble financially, Twitter financially troubled, and so on and so forth, the jobs that, and the monies that these people earned was almost stratospheric for most people in comparison to what they were earning. And did that do anything here? And why the correction? And so many people being fired or let go, or being threatened to be let go if they don't do a better job. And was there too much abuse of money before?
Part of it. I mean, that's part of the issue. I don't really know much about the high tech sector to be able to comment in any great length. I do find it somewhat amusing that one day Google announces that it will basically allow employees to have unlimited vacation time. Next day, it's announcing 10,000 workers are going to be laid off.
Yeah.
So people who are going to have unlimited vacation time are not going to have unlimited vacation, or they'll have unlimited vacation time because they'll be laid off. You think that's a sick joke. But, you know, I think the issue is that, look, when you're talking about growth in high-tech sectors, you are talking about the nature of the economy, which defines two states right now, you know, information technology at the top of the distribution, and then, you know, unskilled workers at the bottom of the distribution. And we've seen that growth in information technology, and basically that explains why you have a rising gap between the bottom, top and the bottom, why we have increasing wage inequality.
Yeah. Well, what about the fact that the president yesterday suggested that it should be permitted for a lot of these big companies who don't permit unionization to be forced to allow that? Does that help the worker to have a union supporting of them? Whether it be the worker, the barista, or the fast food hamburger employee, What does that do? Or does it do anything?
It kind of reverses the clock. I'm not sure it will have the beneficial effects that the president claims will have. I mean, I've certainly argued in the past that we need labor market institutions like the minimum wage. We need labor unions to basically give workers monopoly power, power, bargaining power for their wages. And what we do know is that wage rates have been lower in states where you have right-to-work laws. Right-to-work laws are basically the opposite of forced unionization. Basically, you're free to join the union or not free to join the union. It's an open shop. It bans the closed shop. Basically, what he wants a closed shop. He's saying, well, if you go to work for a company, it's unionized, and you have to join the union. And maybe all companies should be unionized because the workers have some kind of voice. Now, you know, if you mandated that, like you mandated minimum wage, then basically you're giving all workers some semblance of power, and then employers are going to say that it basically artificially raises people's wages. I don't know if it artificially raises their wages any more than the fact that employers, because they have market power, they're artificially deflating people's workers' wages. So, you know, you could play this argument in both directions.
Good.
To say that there's something called natural wage setting is kind of a misnomer, but that's an argument that many conservatives and even neoclassical economists basically rely on. Again, wage rates are set naturally by the marketplace. The marketplace takes into lots of factors, but you know, it is true that if you have institutions in place to depress wages, like right-to-work laws, and sort of what I call an anti-labor institution, you are going to suppress wages. To what extent his proposal would work? One, I don't think it's going to be passed. Two, it's, you know, employers will still find ways to evade union rules and basically avoid paying these wages, even if it means basically taking capital and moving it out of the country.
Which they've done quite often, more so in the last 10 years, I think, than ever before. We're exporting our capacity abroad as well. It's almost like you said, these corporate structures, the people at the top of the food chain, they're there just to make money for the stockholders, and yet we're losing employment here. Is there a way to balance all of this, or are we just going through this change in our workforce? Are we denying our workforce the capacity to earn a living by exporting our production abroad? Is that what's happening? Are we shipping out to Indonesia and Vietnam and in China and wherever you want to look?
We are denying our workers, especially blue-collar workers, an opportunity to make a decent living because we are exporting good jobs out of the country. And all we have left are low-skilled, low-paid service sector jobs. But then on the other hand, we're saying, but we are giving you the opportunity to make a decent living if you, the worker, will take it upon yourself to invest in your upgrading your skills by going to school, by going into training programs or whatever it is that you have to do to acquire the skills necessary to command higher wages. It doesn't have to be a four-year college degree. It can be some kind of technical certificate, you know, like how to service air conditioners, how to install washing machines and fix them and things like that. Those are service sector jobs. They're better paying service sector jobs. It requires some kind of skills certification, auto mechanics and things like that. Working on the assembly line, you know, which also used to be a decent paying job because it was a unionized job, not necessarily because it was skilled. There was the assumption that, you know, they were skilled because they were higher paid, but they were higher paid because they were unionized. Those jobs are gone. And when we talk about doing something for workers, what we are talking about is what we're hoping for. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but what we're hoping for is to bring some of those industries back to the country, to create those opportunities that we can have a blue-collar middle class as we did following World War II.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems that we're automating everything that you could look at. I mean, instead of having people cleaning up the hotels, which was, I don't know how well it was paying, but the point is they now have robots that do that sort of stuff. Are we unemploying our conceivably employable people for machinery as well? Is that the future? Can we ever get back to some sort of normality? Because how does one feed themselves if a robot is doing what you can do? Maybe not what you personally could do, but I mean, you know, that's the other thing too. Are we teaching kids, are we teaching parents who may not even know that there's no way to get by in life unless you do get an education of some sort? And we're failing in education
We're failing in
Rutgers, for example, we have kids that don't even show up in school, and we're pushing them up to graduate year after year after year. You know what we're graduating them to? To poverty and subsidy by a government. That's what's happening.
Well, we are basically, yes, we are feeding that, and we're telling people what we're doing is we're rationalizing. We're saying, well, the economy isn't so bad if you take it upon yourself to acquire the skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our responsibility to give you the skills. It's not our responsibility to even guarantee you a good-paying job. But you know, it's your responsibility as a worker to acquire the skills. And we're giving you the freedom to do that.
Okay, well, I guess there has to be a balance. If you want freedom, you have to decide yourself what you want and what would be best for you. Doesn't that also fail? Because the dynamic is a lot of people don't know what to do. They don't have the education even to contemplate what they must do. A lot of people don't have the ability to save money or don't save money. And at the end of the day, they become a burden on society altogether. Are there different societies out there in the world that we know of that we could say, hey, this is an example where it's working? And why is it working elsewhere, or is it working elsewhere and not working here? How do we compare? Or is the problem with us, with the Fed, that the Fed is engaged in responsibility it shouldn't be involved in?
Well, again, if we want to change the enabling legislation, we have that option to do it. But find a Congress that's willing to do it—that's the challenge. Are we failing our society? What are our priorities? Do we want to make money? The elites certainly want to continue making money, and then don't think they really care about workers. And I think the Federal Reserve Board is serving the interests of the elites. They're not necessarily serving the interests of anybody else.
And is the Fed powerful because they're designated for a long time frame? So I think you mentioned it was 7 years in appointment, and they don't suffer based on their policy, do they? Is that the leverage that they have? They could do what they want, whether it works at the end of the day? And why does it seem that Congress believes that they're doing the right thing if it's failing us by the statistics at the end of the year and the number of people unemployed?
So what's going on is, you know, people have been complaining about inflation. The public has been demanding answers. Somebody can do something about it.
Yeah.
The truth is, you know, we see the inflation rate coming down, but prices aren't coming down. So I'm not sure prices ever will come down. Once prices have increased and the cost X amount of dollars to produce certain goods, there's a limit to how low you can lower your prices. Mm-hmm. That having been said, but the expectation is that somebody will do something. Right. So we've sort of turned to, the administration and Congress have been calling on the Fed to do something. Well, the only tools that the Fed has at its disposal are basically amount to, they're limited tools. You can raise interest rates by raising the prime rate, the best rate you charge your member banks. You can raise reserve requirements mm-hmm. that member banks must have on hand. So basically you're contracting the money supply and making it hard to acquire money, in which case so interest rates go up as a result of that. And that the idea is to basically contain or contract demand for goods and services because people have less money to spend. In other words, if the interest rate on a car loan goes up 2 points, fewer people are going to buy new cars. Okay, fewer people can buy new cars, mm-hmm. then, you know, it's going to have a ripple effect throughout the economy. Mortgage interest rate is basically based on the bond market, but there are probably some impact by the Fed on that as well. Over time, it'll ripple through. The interest rates on mortgages are going to increase as well, in which case, you know, people are going to buy either fewer homes, or they're going to be smaller homes or less expensive homes, something like that. So their choices will be mm-hmm. limited, but that's also going to have an impact on the economy. It's less likely that people are going to actually start building new homes once interest rates go up. Now, the other thing that's been going on is interest rates have been artificially low for, you know, a long period of time. And that's part of the problem. Part of why we've had this housing bubble for so long, which was bound to burst. It's part of the reason why, you know, you raise it by 75 basis points, you know, you basically you're going to have a shock to the system, which is, you know, what we've seen in terms of how the market has responded. I mean, mm-hmm. I find it somewhat surprising that the market has been responding the way it has been. You would think that, okay, an institution which is designed to serve the interests of the banking industry would basically be rallying over the fact that interest rates have increased, because that's good for people who have investments in securities and whatnot. The securities are going to actually go up.
Mm-hmm.
The value of the dollar is strengthened as a result of raising interest rates. So, you know, but all of a sudden they're responding because they're basically saying, "Oh, this means we're heading for a recession." It does mean we're heading for a recession if we continue to do this, mm-hmm. but there's usually a 6-month lag time from the time that the Fed takes an action, makes an announcement, and you actually feel the effects of it.
Uh-huh. So where should we go? What policies should we make that are more conducive to both the needs of the elite, the big corporate structures, and also the worker? Is there a balancing act? Or is this just pie-in-the-sky hope?
Well, maybe we shouldn't be serving the interests of the elite. Maybe we should be serving the interests of workers. I mean, ordinary people, they're the ones who also vote, too. And maybe we should start respecting voice a little more than we've been doing.
Yeah.
What Biden may have been
Does that also require that the worker also start voting? Are they not voting? Do they know what to vote for?
Well,
or do they just vote power, but they don't understand what the ramification may be one way or the other?
if they're not voting, it's largely because they don't feel that there's any point to voting. In other words, they don't think that it will make a difference which party they vote for, because it's basically Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Yeah.
And they also
That's
feel,
very true.
And congressional studies and studies of Congress bear this out, is that members of Congress are not responsive to people who are below a certain income threshold, people not affluent. So the working class people have very, and particularly people at the bottom of the distribution, have very little reason to vote. And we know voting studies show that they are less likely to vote. So it probably is the case that were they to vote, then Congress would have to be more responsive to the new voters who are voting. Which may be why, you know, if you see voting behavior increasing among certain groups because the Democratic Party has gone out to register them to vote in the first place, that's why the Republican Party is so upset about it, because now they have numbers to push for policies which are contrary to what Republicans want. That stands to reason. But I think what you but I think Biden was alluding to when he talked about, you know, workers should be required to be unionized. I mean, again, that's wishful thinking, but he's alluded to in European countries, and you have something called corporatism, where you have a relationship between big government, big labor, and big industry. And basically, they work together to they negotiate over wage rates for different industries. And that's what we probably need here. Instead of saying, well, let's let people just go to work and negotiate for themselves and, you know, just for women they may.
Well, that's the thing. Are there the models in Europe are better than the ones that we have here? But they, you know, we look at Europe as it was, well, they're not quite as successful as the United States, or is that an old concept that has changed from the 1950s? And now it's 75 years later. Has the dynamic changed? Are the Europeans ahead of us from a perspective of paying their workers better?
Again, it depends what your priorities are and what your beliefs happen to be. You know, are they better teacher treating their workers? In some cases, some countries have bad policies on the books that give workers more rights in terms of more time off, minimum pay, and things of that nature. Germany workers are better paid, and the economy is not doing too badly. Switzerland workers have more rights and better pay, and their economy is not doing too badly either. But, you know, there are higher rates of taxation, and that's something that we don't want in the United States. We somehow think that's antithetical to growth. So, you know, it's again, put the question of what your priorities happen to be. We've never put as much priority into the lives of workers.
I'm sorry. For some reason, I didn't hear you.
We've never put tax as much priority to workers as we have to investors. We've put more priority on investors than we have on workers, so that's not necessarily the case in European countries. And some of that may have be a function that you have social democratic parties in European countries. You have labor parties specifically in European countries. We don't have a labor party in the United States. We have a democratic party which has traditionally in the past have and contain labor as part of its coalition, but that's not the same thing as saying it's specifically a labor party.
Right. Hold on one split second. Just got to respond to the door, but that's about it. So where do you think we should go here, or are we just stuck in a stalemate between what Congress can do, what the Fed is going to do, and so on and so forth? Is that the problem?
Well, first thing you need to do is, the question is, can Congress take responsibility to serve the American people and basically adopt policies that are beneficial to all workers as opposed to the elites that are out there. I'm not sure they can. And I don't think it's a question of Democrats versus Republicans. It's a question of elites versus the working class. And basically of elites in both parties.
Thank you. Be well.
Are you feel better?
Thank
you. Good.
Good. Thank you. Sorry about that. So I guess we're just in a quagmire at the moment, so nothing's going to change because there is no will, as you say. The Congress is not doing what it could conceivably do because they have no interest. And what can the worker do, or is the worker impotent in this dynamic?
The worker is basically the one who feels displaced. The worker is the one who basically has been turning. We've seen
yes.
that they have been turning to the candidate to offer what appears to be a more populist message, but the worker thinks is a message that is going to serve their interests.
Mm.
So when the populist candidate who talks about bringing industry back to the United States, bringing manufacturing back, as Trump talked about, didn't deliver, but
mm-hmm.
he talked about it, didn't really do anything about it. It resonates with a lot of people who have been displaced
mm-hmm.
because due to changing economies, due to technological advances, which have resulted in a more skilled workforce at the top and a less non-skilled workforce at the very bottom. A lot of workers seem to be, listen, they're fortunate enough
mm-hmm.
to be members of the skilled labor force. They're perfectly okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem, though, that even the very well-skilled workforce, whether they work for Meta or Twitter or whatever these big companies out there, they're losing their jobs. They were being paid in the stratosphere compared to the regular worker, and yet they're losing their jobs. Did we become excessive here in the United States? Was that like almost a buy-off? So we paid high tech, but high tech is not the only sector that we need to be concerned about. Should we have been? I mean, there were stories that there were people in that worked for Twitter. They were getting paid money for having dinner on the corporate tab. It was like, it seemed so abusive, and yet at the same time it was all permitted. It's not like people didn't know what was going on. So where do we stop? Where do we start? Because we have to stop, but we have to restart. I don't know how to restart.
I think all those corporations, as they grow,
I mean,
become
you don't have
more
to have
successful.
All the
they're
in the
more
world.
Perks.
I mean, I think that's the point.
I mean, corporations are going to be more successful.
Yes.
They're more successful. They're going to have more perks for their employees, and especially those at the top of the food chain
mm-hmm.
in those industries. But I think the question is, can you build a movement among workers to affect some kind of political change? It's not going to happen on its own.
Right, exactly. But we don't seem to have that at the moment. Is it because we're too all individuals and the political parties don't respond always to the needs of the public? But many are still mesmerized by one party or another, which doesn't always bode well for whoever voted for them, whether it be on the right or the left or somewhere in the middle. It's hard to make a judgment call. I think it's a mechanism inappropriate somehow for our economy. Is that the problem? Is there some sort of freedom that one has here as opposed to other places where, like in China, they get a set salary or whatever, and it comes from the top. So even though they may be draconian in many ways, and there's bias and bigotry and some ethnic groups do well and other groups don't. I guess we have some of these same issues here in the United States. But how do other places get along better? And where are we failing? Do we know where we're failing? We just may not know.
Well, I think we know where they're failing. What's going on in those societies where they put more emphasis on worker rights. They don't have the same growth rates as we have in the United States. In some cases, they may have higher levels of unemployment. They have more of a welfare state. They have more of a taxation rate and things of that nature. And we say we don't want any part of that. And, you know, maybe it's because they have more of a corporate sense than we do. We are more individualistic, and that is what drives much of the thinking in the United States. And it's a cultural difference. Which is basically based on ideology, and that's unless we can change that. An elected government is going to basically be responsive to a new way of thinking or some new priorities. Then it's not going to happen. But it's not just the Fed.
To rationalize it.
Well, it's not just the Fed that's basically launching this war on the working class. It's the war on the working class is being launched by elites in government, basically. And the elites in the Democratic Party, which keep pushing green energy, for example, at the expense of workers in certain industries that happen to be higher paying industries at the moment. And we're basically saying, sorry, guys, you can't work because, you know, you're destroying the planet. We're destroying the planet based on what we say, on the reports that we have, our science. And which is, some studies may be accurate, some studies are not. And to basically go ahead and destroy whole industries and people's lives, that's of no consequence to the Young Turks in the green energy movement. So, you know, that I think we need to recognize that it's the elites as a whole have been launching a war on the middle class, and then when ordinary workers actually say something, they complain about the fact that they're not being heard, we at least dismiss them as saying, well, you're simpletons, you know nothing, you don't know what you're talking about.
And yet, why don't we hear a louder voice to express that? You know, for example, they're trying to sell automobiles that don't run on gas, that run on electric, and yet there aren't any places or very few places in comparison where you can't travel beyond a certain point because you have no way to re-electrify and recharge up. You can't go across America by going from one gas station to the next and know that you could travel if you could travel that long, because you could stay awake traveling. But otherwise, you're stuck and you can't recharge. And sometimes it's for even an hour. You're plugged in waiting to recharge, and there aren't even enough places to recharge with electricity along the way. So I don't know why we're selling this stuff. On whose back is this technology going to come down on? Because it's not working. I mean, some people can also afford to spend $90,000 on a Tesla, but not everybody else can.
Well, I mean, again, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. You don't have charging stations because not enough people are buying Teslas. If more people bought Teslas, there'd be a market for charging stations. So to get people to in order to have the infrastructure, you need to get people to buy Teslas in the first place. So you give them a credit, which basically is targeted towards wealthy people because only wealthy people can basically afford to buy the Tesla. So, you know, it's a vicious circle. But nobody's going to invest in charging stations unless there's a market for them, and But on the other hand, a lot of people are not going to invest in these EVs unless there's an infrastructure in place that enables them to travel from one location to another location. But it's not just the infrastructure. It has to be a fast charge. In other words, you have to be able to charge your car in basically the same amount of time it takes you to fill your car up. And if it takes 5 minutes to fill up your car, it takes 20 minutes to an hour or two to charge your car. Nobody's going to sit there for 20 minutes to an hour for two.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole point. Not everyone's got a home where they can plug it into the house and recharge overnight. And who knows how long and how far you could travel in a vehicle like that anyway. So what are we, the technology is important, but is it ready for the consumer? And maybe some people will buy a Tesla because they can afford to buy it, and there's a panache, I'm wealthy enough to be able to buy the product and so on and so forth. But at the end, who does it serve? It does only serve an elite technology, and it isn't quite ready for the regular guy on the street. But is everything supposed to be good for the regular guy on the street? And how much money do you need to earn in order to be able to live, with a new technology? I mean, even a Kia costs $50,000 with these electrical vehicles. $40,000. That's not peanuts for a lot of people.
$40,000.
I don't know where to go.
$40,000 for a car if you're a teacher is a lot of money. It's more money if you're working at Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
You can't afford it at all.
Yeah. Not at all. And all, I guess the thing that's really, really frightening about is all of this dynamic, our reality, is that crime is up because so many people, they see what's out there and they can't afford this, they can't afford that. They're buying goods from abroad because it's cheaper. It may not last as long, but it's affordable at a particular time. And it's like a vicious circle, but we're not serving the entire society. And can we serve a society that may be ignorant and not deciding for themselves that they need to go to school or to need to learn, and because that's their ticket to life in the future? Is that the problem? We're not even telling our kids what they should be doing. Maybe they have no guidance for some reason. Not everyone is that way. It's hard to tell what's right.
I think the larger issue is we're not really investing in education the way we should be. So we're not developing a workforce that could go into higher skilled work. And if we did that, that might be a beginning, but we really need to change how we view education, K-12 education. Set aside the whole question of college and graduate school. I mean, colleges,
mm-hmm.
four-year colleges, have basically become glorified high schools. And basically, we've watered down standards to the point where, people don't know basic math, which they used to. They can't write a sentence the way they used to just graduating high school. And we need to go back to a point where we are investing in serious education, but, it's not just enough to invest in education. Part of it is that the family structure, if you don't have families that attach importance to an education, then, kids going to school are going to tune out. And the other thing is, too many of our students are playing with their devices, their smartphones, and they're not really paying attention. Everything has to sort of be put into a little disk to fit onto computerized imagery.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. You know, they say pre-K and up, if kids do go to a pre-K program, most likely they will finish high school, whereas a lot of other kids just drop out mentally, even though they may be going to school, but they're just not going to be hanging around. Don't know what deflects them from finishing their education. It might be the lack of parental guidance. It says you need to study, and the parents may not be around to assist them, or they may not know. Look, I can't even imagine myself if my parents weren't there, and their education was stunted because of World War II, but they understood what education meant, and they expected me to get an education, and I did. But that was with their guidance and their prodding, so on and so forth. These were not stupid people, but they certainly didn't have the formal education that maybe, you know, from the, you know, the 30s and 40s, it didn't matter so much. But it certainly does now more than ever before. And you can't get a menial job and earn enough money for anything nowadays. And you need the education. So, but at the same time, we probably need people at the bottom end of the totem pole in order to supply other goods. We're getting that now from abroad. So we need to transition somehow. Are we ready for a transition nationally? Doesn't seem like we're going anywhere.
Again, it's a question of what are the priorities of the nation. I don't think we've had that discussion. Again, we basically focus on issues which are meaningless in the lives of most people, and you could see the frustration among voters, especially when it comes to presidential elections. We see the allure of this populist politics. Again, strong people come along and say, I can promise you this, I can promise you that, because the main parties are not delivering on addressing the issues. Democrats are not addressing the issues of what working people need. Basically, they're deflecting to woke issues of you know, inclusion and discrimination and things of that nature and intersectionality. That's the discussion right now. It's really a diversion from the fact they're doing nothing but pursuing policies which hurt the middle class.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, we're really in a quagmire as a nation. And like you're right, there's an overemphasis on color and religion and ethnicity and stuff like that when we should be taking everyone as one issue, guiding our children in one direction so that they could all get an education and become productive, not only for themselves, but for the nation, and that maybe it would be easier for the Fed to make a decision on what to do and what not to do. And maybe for Congress to get the intestinal fortitude to move in the right direction. But are we so gullible that we will continue to believe, you know, the verbiage that we hear from one candidate or the other, including the lies and deceits from people like Santos, who can deceive everybody for a long time? And even though there was one publication out in Long Island that exposed him for what he was, they should have disseminated that information to all media rather than thinking that eventually a small little place could really get out there. Because you have to be large to be able to get out there and get the message out. And a lot of people think the whole world is focused on one little place. You know, I know that we're influential, but, you know, within the limits, I think we cover a good part of Westchester County, which is an influential area. But at the same time, if I want to get a message out, then I share it beyond Westchester County, because it needs to be gotten out there, because it makes a difference. If Albany knows what we're doing, if New York City knows what we're doing, and so on and so forth. So I don't know, but there seems to be a failure all around, no matter how I look at it. And I don't know who's going to guide us out. We need somebody with a view. And, well, you know, I'm very thankful that you reveal so much of this from a standard that is known, even though people may not know exactly what the Fed does, and they may not know what so many different aspects of government do. But if it wasn't for you, I think a lot of people wouldn't know anything. And even I get an education every time I read your essays. So what's the answer? Or is there one? I guess a greater education, a smarter education, a more vast education.
Or at least putting a priority on it.
I'm happy at my age
education.
I can still absorb some of the information that's out there. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, as unfortunately we're at our end of the hour, I want to thank you again for a scintillating article, and I want to go over some of the books that you've written, which are exceptional, and many of those I have already read. So thank goodness for that. So all the best to you. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there we have it, folks, none other than socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman and his most recent discussion today. And hopefully I did it some justice, is his essay entitled The Elite's War on Ordinary Workers Continues. And it's very, very compelling. And hopefully people will recognize it for what it is. And bear with me a moment as I try to get to the next page here. You could find, of course, his essay. You could just look up, if you go to the Yonkers Tribune, you could just look up Orrin in the search engine, and all his articles will come up. Well, his essays will come up. And the one, of course, that was published, the one that we spoke about today, was published yesterday at 4:30. And so if you go to the Yonkers Tribune website and you go to the search engine box, you could just put in Orrin, O-R-E-N, and all of that stuff will come up. It's also on the front page of the Yonkers Tribune website. So when you go to Yonkers Tribune, you'll find it there as well. And but the position on the top articles that we have, well, in this particular case at the moment, when you go to the front page of the Yonkers Tribune, you'll see it at the top left-hand side of the page. And that's it. So that's a beginning. Makes life a little bit easy. But that changes during the day. So some will be able to see it right away and others will not, depending on what time they come onto our website, because things change all the time. So that being the case, let's move on to some other things, particularly with some of the works that he's done. I want to give that to you in a moment. Well, first thing you should know that you can visit Dr. Orrin M. Levin-Waldman's own website page, which is known as Labor Econ. Yet when you go to the website, you have to look up www.econlabor.com. So it's econlabor.com. And then the works that he's published are quite enormous. The first one is Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Middle Class. And this is a publication that was issued by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E, that's the publisher. Another work is Understanding Public Policy in the United States. And this one is published under Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T, and another exceptional work. The first time I became aware of Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman was when he wrote his book called The Minimum Wage. And The Minimum Wage is a reference handbook, and this was issued or published by CLIO, C-L-I-O, and it's a division of ABC. So it, well, you, when you go to the website and you look up under Oren, you'll be able to see all the books that he's published. This was a mind blower. This one, which is called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory. Very esoteric, but very understandable. It's now in paperback, and this was published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. Routledge is a very esoteric publisher, and it's a phenomenal work. Then you have The Case of the Minimum Wage. The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models. This was issued by State University of New York Press. So you could find, again, the links to all of these books and how to retrieve them and where you can get them. Just exceptional works, and I think it'll be worth your while to even consider reading them. Now, bear with me a moment. I want to check on a couple of other things. Looks like we're fine at this end. I'm going to go back here. We're good here. And and this is give you an idea of some of the things that are coming about. And let's look at some of the news on 1 second here. Okay, this is will be important for a lot of people. It seems that the wholesale egg prices have collapsed. And 1 second. Okay. All right, 1 second here. All right, so egg prices rose to record highs in December. A dozen large grade A eggs had more than doubled in price during the 2022 on average. So a historic outbreak of bird flu in the United States disrupted egg production and supply, economists have said. So wholesale egg prices have fallen by more than 50% since December, according to Erner Barry data. So retail egg prices may soon follow, but it's not a sure thing. So wholesale egg prices have cratered in recent weeks from record highs, meaning consumers may soon see relief at the grocery store. But the dynamics of egg pricing from the wholesale to retail, a retail market, in addition to other factors, means that's not a sure thing in the short term. Prices fell to $2.61 per dozen eggs on Monday, a 52% decrease from the peak of around $5.43 on December 19, and 47% decrease from the beginning of 2023, according to Erner Barry, a research firm, a market research firm that specializes in the wholesale food industry. Its Midwest large white egg price benchmark is a widely cited barometer in the egg industry. So prices have collapsed, as Angel Rubio, senior analyst at Erner Barry, quote, that's a big, big adjustment downward, end quote. So The historic bird flu outbreak led to soaring egg prices. In a year characterized by historically high inflation, egg prices were a standout in 2022, rising faster than almost all other consumer items. Average retail prices increased nearly 60% in 2022, according to the Consumer Price Index. In December, a dozen large grade A eggs cost consumers $4.25 on average, more than double the $1.79 a year earlier, according to monthly Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Well, amid inflation, turn to dollar stores for groceries, savers poised for big win in 2023 as inflation falls, and 64% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So the deadliest outbreak of bird flu in history hit the United States in 2022, killing millions of birds and significantly disrupting egg supply, according to food economists. The disease, which is contagious and lethal, affects many types of birds, including egg-laying hens. Cases typically fade by summer, but that didn't happen in 2022. New outbreaks coincided with peak demand around the winter holiday season. Highly pathogenic avian influenza ultimately killed about 58 million birds across 47 states, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The prior record was set in 2015 when 50.5 million birds had died. Typically, when a case of bird flu is detected, farmers must cull their flocks as a precaution to contain spread of the disease, economists said. It can take months for that farm to start producing and selling eggs again, and meanwhile, buyers must find new suppliers so they can stock shelves, a dynamic that's played out nationwide and raised prices. One group, Farm Action, asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate the possibility that a, quote, collusive scheme, end quote, among egg suppliers rather than the bird flu is what has kept prices elevated, a contention that is largely downplayed by food economists. Now, farmers get a reprieve and consumers show resistance. There haven't been any new bird flu outbreaks among commercial table egg-laying birds since December 20, according to the United States Department of Agriculture. A prolonged period without setbacks in egg production has given suppliers a reprieve and the market time to recover, said Brian Moscoguri, a global trade strategist, Eggs Unlimited, one of the largest egg suppliers in the United States. Now, consumer demand also typically wanes in January and February, further alleviating price pressures, Moscoguri had said. The USDA gently cited consumer resistance to record high prices in grocery outlets across the country as another reason for the declining and below average egg demand. Wholesale prices have been declining steadily from their late 2022 highs, which has helped support retailer efforts to bring pricing down to a more consumer acceptable level, the USDA said on February 3rd. Well, weekly retail egg data from the USDA is spotty, and it's difficult to see how cratering wholesale prices may be translating in the retail market. On average, it takes about 4 weeks for retail prices to reflect wholesale price trends, Rubio said. And that means consumers may start to see some relief in February, he said. Retail prices tend to be less volatile than those at the wholesale level. For every 10% decrease or increase in wholesale egg price, consumers can expect retail prices to shift about 2% on average, Rubio had said. However, egg demand also generally increases in the weeks preceding Easter, which this year falls on April 9, making it hard to determine how prices will respond, Rubio continued. Well, there are other factors that may keep retail egg prices elevated for longer, however. Supermarket chains and other egg retailers don't all peg their shelf prices to movements in wholesale prices, economists said. They may buy eggs from suppliers according to different formulas, Some are at least partially tied to the price of corn and soybeans, for example, which are a big cost in raising and feeding chickens, Moschiori had said. So while prices for those commodities are down from highs following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in early 2022, they remain historically elevated. And some supermarkets may have tried keeping egg prices down so as not to dissuade customers from buying and may now try to recoup some of their losses before lowering retail prices, Moschiori had said. It's kind of up to the retailer as to how quickly they want to pass prices along, he said. So while bird flu hasn't affected commercial egg-laying flocks since December, there have been confirmed cases among other types of birds, meaning it's still, quote, a major risk heading into the spring migration, Moschiori continued. The first case among egg layers last year was detected on February 22. Wow. So very, very compelling and something that we need to look at for sure. Here's some other things that you might find interesting as well. It seems that a neuroscientist shared the four highly coveted skills that set introverts apart, and their brains work differently, evidently. This is an article by Frederica Fabricius, who is a contributor. Well, being the most talkative person in the room may be a good way to get people's attention, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have the best ideas. As a neuroscientist, I've worked with large companies like Google and Deloitte on how to attract and retain top talent, and I found that employers tend to favor extroverts. But there are some surprising strengths that introverts bring to the table, and they shouldn't be overlooked. As best-selling author Susan Cain points out in her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, extroverts are more likely to focus on what's happening around them. It's as if extroverts are seeing what is, while their introverted peers are asking what if. What sets introverts apart from extroverts? Don't get me wrong. Both extroverts and introverts have wonderful qualities, but research shows that introverts may have the upper hand. Here are four highly coveted skills that set introverts apart from everyone else. One, introverts think more. Gray matter, which exists in the outermost layer of the brain, serves to process and release new information in the brain. One Harvard study found that introverts' brains work differently and have thicker gray matter compared to extroverts. In people who are strongly extroverted, gray matter was consistently thinner. Introverts also showed more activity in the frontal lobes, where analysis and rational thought take place. Another study that scanned brains of both introverts and extroverts found that even in a relaxed state, the introverted brain was more active and increased blood flow. Introverts can focus longer. When Albert Einstein, a known introvert, was a child, his teachers thought he was a quiet loner who seemed a million miles away, lost in his thoughts. Einstein said, quote, "It's that I stay with problems longer," he said. This ability to focus intensely is a key characteristic of introverts who often have more extended focus than extroverts. Because they enjoy spending time alone, introverts tend to be more willing than extroverts to put in the hours alone necessary to master a skill. Introverts are often gifted in a specific field. On average, introverts and extroverts are the same in terms of intelligence, but statistics show that around 70% of gifted people are introverts. People are considered gifted, quote-unquote, when they exhibit above-average intelligence or a superior talent for something such as music, art, or math. If your workplace is dominated by extroverts who criticize those who prefer to work alone or skip after-work cocktails, not team players, end quote, it may inadvertently alienate gifted people. Introverts do the right thing. Introverts tend to be less swayed by external events and driven more by their inner moral compass. A 2013 study on social conformity found that extroverts are more willing to go along with the opinion of the majority, even if it's wrong. Extroverts are more likely than introverts to succumb to social pressure. The researchers concluded, quote, that the higher the pressure, a larger number of conforming responses are given by extroverts. In contrast, there is no difference in conforming responses given to high and low pressure levels by introverts. So how to create a workplace where introverts thrive? Introverts are often exhausted in their workplace because many of their colleagues don't know how to harness the power introversion. Here's how managers can create an introvert-friendly workplace. Respect boundaries. It takes up to 23 minutes for a person to regain focus after they have been interrupted. Don't expect people to answer every email or Slack message immediately. Brainstorm alone. Letting people shout ideas at each other in a room sounds like fun, but research shows that if you want to maximize creativity, let people generate ideas by themselves before sharing them in a group. Bonus, your introverts will be far more comfortable sharing. Shorten meetings. Many introverts, as you can probably guess, are not fans of meetings. Let go of the idea that the entire office has to be invited to every meeting so that no one feels left out. Don't force a certain type of communication. The introverts in your office may prefer emails, while the extroverts might enjoy handling business on the phone. Encourage people to decide how they want to communicate, like whether to turn their cameras on or off, even if it differs from yours. Now, provide the option of privacy. Extroverts may love to see everybody all the time, but introverts tend to need privacy. The solution is a flexible work environment that provides silence and private space for introverts and lively, interactive, open space for extroverts. As an introvert, my general message to employers is let my people rest. Like it or not, the future of work is all about more choices, autonomy, and a culture that embraces introversion. Now, Frederica Fabricius is a neuroscientist and a trailblazer in the field of neuroleadership. She has given talks at large organizations, including Google, Accenture, Deloitte, BMW, and Audi, and serves on the prestigious German Academy of Science and Engineering. She's also the best-selling author of The Leading Brain, Neuroscience Hacks to Work Smarter, and The Brain-Friendly Workplace, Why Talented People Quit and How to Get Them to Stay. And you can follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So again, let me give you her name again. Her name is Frederica, Friederike. Again, her first name is Frederica, Friedike. And her last name, Fabricius, is F like Frank, A B like boy, Fabritius. Again, her last name is Fabricius, F as in Frank, A B as in Bravo, R-I-T like Tom, I-U-S. And you could find her on Facebook, on Twitter, and so on. So I think you'll find that very, very compelling. And this is important. This comes from the IRS. why the IRS says that that people should hold off filing their tax returns if they received a relief check in 2022. If you qualify for special checks or rebates related to either tax surpluses or inflation in 2022, you might want to hold off on filing your tax return, the Internal Revenue Service had said. The agency is clarifying whether these special state tax rebates should be taxed federally. An IRS spokesperson advised CNBC, the rules surrounding them are complex and will require more time to determine the tax implications, according to an IRS statement. Quote, we expect to provide additional clarity for as many states and taxpayers as possible by next week. The IRS recommends that tax filers who qualified for relief checks wait until additional guidance is available or consult with a reputable tax professional. The IRS also recommended that those who have already filed the 2022 tax return not file an amendment. It's not yet clear which specific states require more guidance, but at least 18 enacted one-time refunds in 2022, according to the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Massachusetts, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Carolina, and Virginia. And most of those 18 states are still waiting to confirm whether the rebates will incur federal taxes, says Richard Auxier, a Tax Policy Center senior policy associate. Federal taxation will depend on federal law and the stated purpose for each rebate, according to the Wall Street Journal. Stimulus payments related to COVID-19 relief were not taxable, but it's possible that rebates related to inflation relief or tax surpluses might qualify for federal taxation. Each state relief program is run differently too, which adds to the confusion. In California, for example, a special middle-class tax refund meant to recover the cost of rising inflation won't be taxed by the state, according to the state's franchise tax board, but it also concedes that the funds could be taxed federally. Similarly, in New Mexico, state taxes on a 2022 refundable income tax rebate meant to cover rising costs will not be charged, according to the state's taxation and federal and revenue department website. However, the site also says that the department cannot comment on any federal tax consequences of the rebates and relief payments. So in the meantime, tax filers who have qualified for relief checks or tax rebates might want to wait until there's more guidance from the IRS before filing if they haven't filed already. So, very, very important stuff. Now, let's quickly look at some other issues, which hopefully you'll find compelling. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. All right, one second. Now, this is very interesting from the chancellor from Germany, Scholz, says that Putin, quote, will not achieve his goals in Ukraine, end quote. The chancellor addressed parliamentarians regarding the upcoming European Union special summit in Brussels. Topics on the agenda in the Belgian capital include climate protection, the war in Ukraine, and migration. So German Chancellor Olaf Scholz gave a speech at the Bundestag on Wednesday highlighting the, quote, shocking images, end quote, in the aftermath of the earthquake across Turkey and Syria and the man-made disaster that is the war in Ukraine. The address from Scholz, a Social Democrat SPD, comes on the eve of a special European Union summit set to take place in Brussels tomorrow. On the earthquake in Turkey and Syria, Scholz began his speech by addressing the earthquake that has killed thousands of people this week across Turkey and Syria, over 11,000 actually, the latest figures. Shocking images in the news have been reaching us, he says. We are shocked in the face of so much destruction, Scholz advised. The federal government has immediately promised support to the Turkish government, he continued. I spoke to Turkish President Erdogan yesterday on the war in Ukraine. He then addressed what he described as a man-made disaster, the war in Ukraine, which has sparked the biggest migration movement since World War II, Scholz advised. Quote, from the first day of the war, our strongest characteristic lies in our cohesion. We will simply not allow a country to invade another and disrupt peace in Europe. And Scholz said that the European Union sanctions, quote, will continue, end quote, against Russia, end quote, and may even be enhanced, end quote. Scholz also assured Ukraine that its future lies in the European Union ahead of the first anniversary of Russia's invasion. Quote, Ukraine belongs to Europe. Its future lies in the European Union, and this promise holds true, Scholz had said. On Tuesday, Russia's defense minister said that Western arms supplies to Ukraine were effectively dragging NATO into the conflict, warning this could lead to an unpredictable escalation. But Scholz hit back as he said, it is not NATO at war against Russia. It is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Quote, Putin will not achieve his goals, not on the battlefield and not through a dictated peace, end quote, Scholz had vowed. This is clear after 1 year of this war. Well, there's a debate to follow the address. A 90-minute debate followed Scholz's speech in the Bundestag. Deputy Chancellor Robert Habeck, who's a member of the Green Party, and Chancellery Minister Wolfgang Schmidt, the SPD, faced questions from members of parliament. Habeck told lawmakers that the European Union subsidy package to promote the climate-friendly restructuring of the economy needed to be reworked ahead of the upcoming EU summit in March. We don't have much time, he said, adding that the package needs to be made more concrete. It comes as a response to a similar package put forward in the United States to boost the production of wind turbines, solar cells, batteries, and electric vehicles. Other items on Wednesday's agenda include a debate on the crisis in the housing market and a motion on restricting citizenship laws put forward by the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, Alternative for Germany. The leaders of the 27 European Union members are set to take part in a two-day gathering where Ukraine policy is likely to be the focus again. Also on the agenda in Brussels will be how climate change policies affect business and the issue of migration. Now, 1 second here. This, I think, you may find interesting. There is everyday racism in Germany. Bullied, insulted, subtly shamed, people with a visible migration background report about their experiences with racism in Germany in a new book. When Patricia Jen Lynn Freimuth moved to a new apartment in Munich with her husband, she was asked if she was a new cleaning lady. In her essay in the book, People of Deutschland, the People of Germany, the public relations expert with German and Chinese roots reports on the racist, quote, background noise, end quote, that she and her sister keep experiencing as people of Asian descent in Germany. Germany sees itself as a liberal country and has perceived in 2023 as much more cosmopolitan than before the turn of the millennium. Since the 2006 World Cup, it has often been said that Germany has become more colorful, given the rise in diversity in the media and in politics. Observers might get an impression that racism is waning in the country. However, there is no reason to relax, according to the government's first annual report on racism, which was recently presented by Germany's Integration and Anti-Racism Commissioner, Reem Al-Bali Radovan. According to the report, which focuses on the perspectives of the people actually affected, everyday racism in Germany manifests itself not only in physical acts of violence and verbal attacks. People who clearly have a migrant background also experience discrimination at school, in sports clubs, when looking for housing, at work, or by the police. There are many painful experiences. Released during Black History Month, Deutschland is a book that focuses on the personal experiences of people with a visible migration background. Among them are celebrities like the author and activist Jüzin Tekal, the TV presenter Mola Adebisi, and Hans Selpai, a former professional soccer player. Regular people, too, share their experiences of everyday racism, which can often be more harmful than ideology-driven racism, argues the editor, Martina Rink. Everyday racism comes with a paradox that it can come from anyone and everyone, even people who genuinely like you and don't notice when they hurt you, she said. Both Rink, who has Persian roots and grew up in the United Kingdom and Germany, and co-editor and creative manager Simon Usifo, son of a Nigerian father and a French mother, contributed essays to People of Deutschland. The 45 personal stories are complemented with photos of Berlin-based photographer Sammy Hart, who is known for his sensitive portraits. Unconscious Bias and Physical Violence. Since the book has stories on latent racism, microaggression, which can be unconscious, bias, prejudices, and stereotypes, Usifo advised Deutsche Welle, the German world. It ranges all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is psychological and physical violence. Actually, everything is represented in the book. The aim of the book, he said, is not to take militant action against racist people, but to educate readers about the fact that everyone has prejudices because we are socialized that way, and that you can also recognize racist patterns and actively change them. Basically, it's like a muscle you have to exercise, said Usifo. If you approach people and develop sensitivity because of these stories, then you can work on it. For a Black man, you sure look good. Mola Adebisi, a German TV presenter and singer, describes in his entry how, at the height of his success in the late 1990s, a detective came to see him one day in his office and told him that the record cover of a neo-Nazi band showed him alongside singer Farin Urlaub und Campino as a hanged man, and that he was insulted in one of their songs. Quote, up to that point, I had had no experience with racism or xenophobia, Adebisi wrote in the book, adding that he had seemingly lived his life naively and with a lot of luck. Quote, everything changed. Now I was accompanied by bodyguards at every gig. When I was on the road, it was no longer about partying and being in a good mood, but level three police security. Now I only enter my studio via the loading dock. He wrote that he started listening very carefully to every word, even if something was said without a thought. I registered latent nationalism everywhere. On planes, I was always addressed in English. Supposed compliments were poisoned and saturated with racism. For a Black man, you sure look good. If that's what being German feels like, I thought it's damn hard to feel German. I know what racism feels like. In 2020, Terpil Temiz Unvar's son, Ferhat, was killed in a racially motivated attack in the German town of Hanau. In school, he faced racist verbal violence from teachers and had to repeat a class although he had just one really poor grade. He understood early on that it was a structural problem and later tried to create awareness surrounding it. He was 22 years old when he was killed. Why was someone like the assassin allowed to have a gun in the first place, asked his mother in the book. Quote, there were so many clues that were not followed up. In my eyes, the assassin was allowed to legally practice killing our children for years thanks to his gun license. End quote. Continuing, the attack in Hanau was not only directed at my son, but at all migrants, said Delpil Temiz Unvar. Quote, I learned that we have to fight for ourselves, so I decided to speak up. On November 14 of 2020, on what would have been his birthday, I founded the Ferhat Unvar Education Initiative, end quote. Continuing, she said, I know that what racism feels like and what it means, especially for single women, added Unvar. I know their fears. The school fights against them, even if they can't defend themselves, end quote. In the name of the Ferhat Unvar Initiative, Tapir Temiz Unvar confronts the authorities, not only in Hanau, but all over Germany. Quote, I want to show how deeply rooted racism is in schools and offices, she wrote, adding that she has experienced it herself and her friends have similar stories to tell. The harmful impact of everyday racism is underestimated by the majority. Quote, ideological racism a la Ku Klux Klan, end quote, is not the biggest problem in our society, said Usifo. Quote, the major problem is that we have a majority society that partly doesn't experience racism itself and therefore completely underestimates how violent and how hurtful everyday life can be, end quote. That is where, quote, people of Deutschland comes in. The mix of people from different backgrounds and celebrities from the music, sports, art, and fashion sector, he and Martina Rink hope to reach a wide range of people instead of, quote, just arguing into this bubble that's already convinced itself, end quote. Rink and Usifo plan to donate the proceeds from the book to Duzen Tekal's German Dream Independent Education Initiative, which works toward making sure that democracy, tolerance, and pluralism are carried into the future. Racism is a problem for society as a whole, they said, and it needs to be faced by all people in Germany. Quote, in everyday life, we are all simply not immune, even if not driven by a negative intention, to unconsciously and reflexively think, act, and communicate in a racist way, Rink wrote in the press booklet for People of Deutschland. It's not enough to not perceive ourselves as racist. We all need to actively confront racism, added Lucifo. So, my goodness, definitely something that we need to think about, certainly in Germany, and it's important to see how it's like in other communities as well, and that racism is evidently, as was written in the article, everywhere. And so that's how things are. Now, let's look at this. We've got about a few minutes left. China is continually undermining a rules-based order. John Kirby, the coordinator for strategic communications at the National Security Council in the White House, said in a talk about what kind of impact the recently downed spy balloon could have on U.S.-Chinese relations. So, one second here. Let me just look. One moment. It looks for some reason I may have misplaced can't believe it. I misplaced the article, so forgive me. All right, let me just quickly look here for a moment on our main site. One moment. I think you'll find this interesting. I've been so busy on so many fronts with so much concern that we haven't been able to post a lot of the articles from the Savvy Senior. And I think you'll find this interesting. The Savvy Senior is a column written by Jim Miller. And this first article that we posted only yesterday is Simple Home Safety Solutions for Aging in Place. Seems that a letter was written to Jim Miller to his column called Dear Savvy Senior, and a concerned daughter writes, "Falls and fires are the two things I worry most about my elderly father who lives alone. Do you have any suggestions on what we can do to help keep him safe and keep an eye on him from afar?" "Of course," he says, "there are a number of small adjustments and modifications you can make to your dad's home to help protect him from falls and fires, both of which cause thousands of injuries and deaths each year. Here are some tips to get you started. Eliminate tripping hazards. Since falls are the leading cause of home injury among seniors, a good place to start is to pack away your dad's throw rugs, which are common tripping hazards, or use carpet tacks or double solid tape to secure them. You may also need to adjust your dad's furniture so there are clear pathways to walk through and position any electrical or phone cords along walls and out of the way. For hardwood steps, consider attaching a non-slip tread to each one to provide traction and to help him see the edge. And for added protection in the bathroom, buy some non-skid rugs for the floors and use adhesive, non-slip, or a mat with rubber suction inside his tub or shower stall. Improve his lighting. Good lighting is essential for safe aging in place, so check the wattage ratings on your dad's lamps and light fixtures, and install the brightest bulbs allowed, and add supplementary lighting if necessary. You should also purchase some dusk to dawn night lights for the bathroom and in the hallways that light up when the sun goes down, and mount some motion sensor lights outside the front and back doors and in the driveway that automatically comes on when he comes and goes after dark. Get grab bars. These can significantly reduce his risk of bathroom falls. Install them where he enters the shower or tub and on a wall inside the stall, but don't use grab bars that attach with suction. Instead, they have wall-mounted bars put in by someone who can affix them to the wall studs. It's also best to choose bars whose surfaces are slightly textured and easier to grip. Ensure railings are stable. Wherever he has steps, stairways, entryways, or basement, he needs sturdy railings. Ideally, they should be on both sides of the steps. Preventing cooking fires. There are several affordable products you can purchase to help your dad prevent home cooking fires, like burner alert discs attached to a stove's knob and will continuously blink or beep after the stove has been in use for a preset amount of time. And OME smart knobs that can control a stove's heating setting from an app, or you can invest in a more expensive iGuard stove sensor that shuts the stove off when he doesn't detect motion for 5 minutes. Install smoke alarms. Install a smart smoke alarm in your dad's house. Buy one for each floor. That will alert him when smoke or carbon monoxide is detected. These smart devices will also send alerts to your phone to let you know when a problem is detected. Google Nest and First Alert, both smart smoke and carbon monoxide detectors. Add fire extinguishers. Get portable, multi-purpose fire extinguishers for each level of your dad's house and in the garage. Consider a medical alert to ensure your dad's safety and provide you some peace of mind. Consider getting him a medical alert device that comes with a wearable SOS button that would allow him to call for help if he were to fall or need assistance. So for more tips, get a copy of AARP's Home Fit Guide so you could see aarp.org/homefit, which has more than 100 aging-in-place suggestions that can help make your dad's home safer and easier to live in. So you could send your senior question to Savvy Senior at P.O. Box 5443. That's in Norman, N-O-R-M-A-N, Oklahoma, OK. So Norman, OK. Zip code there, 73070. Or you can visit SavvySenior.org. And Jim Miller is a contributor to the NBC Today Show and author of the Savvy Senior book. So if you go to the Yonkers Tribune and you go to the search box on the upper right-hand corner, you could just put in Jim Miller or the Savvy Senior, and you'll see his most recent article. And in fact, if you go to the Yonkers Tribune website at the moment, bear with me a second. I think that the article, one minute. Let me see where it is. Well, The Elite's War on Ordinary Workers continues by socioeconomic research scholar Oren M. Levin. Waldman is on the top left-hand side of the page, and under that is a Savvy Senior Simple Home Safety Solutions for Aging in Place, written by Jim Miller. So those are the top two articles at the moment, and so on. Now that changes during the day as we move and upload with more articles that we believe are of interest to you, and so on and so forth. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see what's what. In case you haven't heard, where is it here? One moment, where is it? I don't know where the date is. Nikki Haley will run for president. This is an article written by Faggy Holt. So she's the former South Carolina governor. And the Charleston Daily reported that staffers are inviting supporters to attend a special announcement in Charleston in 2 weeks. So it'll be another week more before she will likely announce her bid as a Republican presidential nominee. So that's interesting. And so we have about another week to wait before she will come out and advise us what she plans to do. Yeah, so that's what it is. Okay, so I think that's where we are today. I want to thank you for being with us. Thanks for your patience. And hopefully we've been pertinent in today's discussion because I saw there were a lot of people that did attend the show. So hopefully you enjoyed it. All right, so let me move on. We'll get off the Blog Talk Radio platform and we'll say goodbye.